Any life secret to spill? Any drama? Any exciting, depressing, anything?
I guess at work today, so we found it a while back, but just a little, if you imagine like a shoebox, it'd probably fit in, I don't know, two-thirds of that, a little baby steam engine. Was really cute, and so we
That's
obviously had to try
adorable.
it, see if it worked, so
Yeah.
filled it up with some water, overfilled it, had to pour some back out, and it just plugs into the wall. With the heater element, and so plugged it in, and you could hear it like start to heat the water up and start boiling and all that stuff, and like put up a little shield, a little blast shield, because it was turning into a pressure vessel, obviously, and we didn't, it was old, and
Jeez.
yeah, so we're like, oh, let's just be safe, and but it fired up, and it was just humming along. It was
That's
awesome.
cute.
I sent you a video of
That's what
it.
you sent me a video of? That's
Yeah.
funny.
That was a lot of fun. So it's cool to see that working and just to see the
Oh.
simplicity of it, but also how I don't
Would
know, it
it?
was just really cool.
That's cute. I'll have to try to find if I can add that to our socials if you go with it. Love your outfit. That's
Oh,
great.
thank you. Yes.
Would it have been used for anything? Is it
Just
literally just like, this is
like
what a steam
a
engine looks
toy
like?
display, something like that. Great toy if so. If your kids plug this into the wall, there's no ground plug on it.
Uh-oh.
Nothing like that. It's just plug it into the wall and get ready for some pressure and don't burn yourself. So
That's
yeah,
hilarious.
I don't know if it was a toy way back when or just a display or what, but it
Do
works
you
and
know
pretty
if
cool.
it's a triple expansion
It's not. I'm
variety?
quite sure it's not a triple
Aww.
expansion, but
That's a
it was
bummer.
really cool to operate a little miniature steam engine, so that was pretty neat.
Yeah. That would be cute. Looks like a little like a train almost.
Yeah, no, pretty much. I mean, that's there also was a little pulley behind the flywheel, so you technically could put something on it. I mean, it would have to be a very light load. It was not yeah, it was
It's not going to be hauling stuff around the Great Lakes anytime
No,
soon,
but it
is
was
what you're
super cool.
saying.
It was really cool to see and to operate. So,
I like it. That's cool. Congratulations on your little find. That's
thank
awesome.
you. Yeah, that was fun.
I like it. Who knew?
Hello.
Oh, wait.
And welcome to the Under the Waves podcast, a show about all things shipwrecks, baby steam engines, broken dams, and more on and near the Great Lakes. My name is Andrew. I'm your captain. I'm back.
And I'm Michelle. I needed a stroke reset from the last episode, so sorry to our poor editor. Welcome aboard this week's episode.
So we did mention, someone mentioned last week that this next episode, today's episode, might be Great Lakes adjacent. We've had one or two of those before. Let us know if you like it. It's in the vicinity, and it's also something we had mentioned previously. So after mentioning this disaster, it was one of the worst in U.S. history. Our researcher was just a little bit curious and decided to do a deep dive. We decided to have her document her findings. And here we are today, talking about the Johnstown flood of 1889. To a layperson, the South Fork Dam was a rather impressive structure, but to the people who owned it and lived below it in the Conemaugh Valley, that is Conemaugh Valley, it was a headache and a menace. This is a bit of the history of a structure that was never given as much care and attention as it so desperately required. And eventually it made its demands known.
Dun dun dun.
Now, today's story starts with a construction project, as most do. The plan was to be able to provide the best means for commercial transportation between Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. This would be done via railways, canals, and various roads. This project would also include the creation of a reservoir in order for the canal system to supply water during low-flow, drier periods. But what does a river need in order to become a reservoir? A dam. DAM.
So watch your language, boy.
Now, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania set out to build this new dam, which would later be called the South Fork Dam. Construction for this started in 1838. And a quick little side tangent, did you know that Pennsylvania is technically a commonwealth and not a state? Commonwealth itself is an old English term for, quote, a political community founded for a common good, end quote.
Sums it up nicely.
Yeah. Kentucky, Massachusetts, and Virginia are also considered commonwealths. Commonwealth is more of a part of their official names, and it doesn't affect these states politically, legally, or socially in terms of being governed by the U.S. government. So does that technically mean, what, there's 46 states?
I guess if you technically, yes, but it doesn't really affect them at all. So it's just kind of like, it's a state slash commonwealth. We call it a commonwealth, but they just operate as states.
46 states, as four commonwealths, and a partridge.
How many? How many territories you got? I don't know.
No idea. But some still hold on. Okay. But some still hold on to the community-based mindset of providing for the good of everyone. And back to the construction of the South Fork Dam. The plan was to make use of the earth and rock fill arrangement that was to be around 72 feet high, or 21.9 meters, 931 feet long, or 283.8 meters, and 40 feet wide, which is 12.2 meters at the top or the crest, and 500 feet wide at the base.
And to add another number, the U.S. has 14 territories, 5 are inhabited, so no one came back swinging at me.
Thank you.
That's all.
Thanks. The dam itself had two ways of controlling the reservoir's water levels. However, one had a way greater level of control than the other option, but this was relatively normal and considered standard for a construction such as this for this time. There was a control tower on the side of the dam the reservoir was also on. This was provided for the outlet works and consisted of 5 cast iron pipes. Each of these pipes had a valve for releasing varying amounts of water in a flow that then ran into a stone culvert that had a discharge chamber. This chamber led down to the downstream side of the dam.
I think this is kind of like what most dams have now. It's a sort of like you can siphon off water and send it underneath the dam and then just like regulate the level of the reservoir. I know where our grandma lives, she has something like that on the river that she's on. And you can see the water coming out the bottom, and that's kind of what that is. And I guess that's easier to control.
Hmm. I like
which
it.
I never looked into how dams worked. I just kind of was like, oh, that's there, and it's stopping the water, and that's cool. But
it is
there's a lot that goes into it.
There is a lot that goes into them.
Yeah. And then seeing how this changes throughout time is just like, oh, man. It was not an if, it was a when, which is unfortunate.
Tough nuggets. The second method of water level control was the good old-fashioned spillway. This was a channel that was cut into the rock along the east abutment. And an abutment is the part of the dam's structure that connects the man-made dam to the natural valley sides, or dam foundations. Abutments act as support and hold the ends of the dam in place, transferring the immense pressure from the impounded water along with the dam's weight into the bedrock or soil. The spillway for the South Fork Dam was about 70 feet wide, which is 21.3 meters, although the original plans before the dam was built was for the spillway to be a minimum of 150 feet wide, 45.7 meters. The brand new dam was finally completed around 1853, 15 years after construction was started.
That seems like a long time, but figuring out how much water they have to like divert for a sec and then build up, I don't know if that's a long time.
I feel like for the time that was probably pretty standard. I think modern it might be a little quicker, but I mean it's still a massive undertaking, so... I am no dam construction expert either, so I am not sure the average time. But if you do know, please let us know under the wayspodcast@gmail.com. What is the average water stopper dam construction build time look like? And obviously it varies for the size of the impediment. But let us know if you know.
What a nice thesaurus you have over there. Hoover Dam took 5 years for reference.
I feel like that is also like, here's your bigger channel. that's it, versus like, let's find a valley, let's do this. I told you I didn't know.
I mean, this blocked up a river, but it wasn't like as big a river as what turned into the lake. I don't know.
No idea. Anyway, moving on. The non-professionals.
Thinking out loud.
The highly sought-after canal system would, however, unfortunately fall victim to one of the Industrial Revolution's greatest achievements, the railroad system. A mere 5 years after the South Fork Dam was completed, it became abandoned and sold off to the Pennsylvania Railroad, the PRR. The PRR, or otherwise known as PRR.
Forgot
that's
I was
a joke.
Needed.
Not really interested in owning a dam, and nor the upkeep and maintenance of said dam, was left pretty low on the company's list of things to do. In July of 1862, just under a decade after the dam was completed, the South Fork would experience its first failure. At this time, the outlet works stone culvert collapsed, which caused a portion of the dam to breach or deteriorate gradually. This whoopsie-doopsie drained the lake in half a day's time.
That's a big whoopsie doopsie.
I would say so. The Pennsylvania
Railroad. I lost half the lake.
Way to go! The Pennsylvania Railroad saw this as their opportunity. Let me try this again.
You're having a breach in your system.
The Pennsylvania Railroad saw this as their opportunity to sell off the parcel of land that they so badly did not want. So in 1875, the dam and the lake was sold to John Riley. Really? Riley.
Riley. I think it's Riley.
Yeah. A former congressman. And he didn't hold on to it very long either, as the large piece of property was again sold in 1879 to Benjamin R. Ruff.
It's F.
That's an F.
Gotta go over your alphabet again.
I was thinking of Fluff. I was lucky to say the right name right.
Benjamin R. Fluff.
That'd be a great name. He didn't hold on to it for very long either, as the large piece of property was again sold later, 4 years later, in 1879, to Benjamin F. Ruff. But before doing so, Riley, assuming he was making a loss in selling the dam, lake, and surrounding area, decided to remove the 5 cast iron discharge pipes and sell them off for scrap metal. Not a great decision for the dam in the long run. That's brutal. And to play devil's advocate, these accusations have been disputed throughout the years, and the truth has been lost to history and time. For sure, the pipes were dug out and sold to scrap. We just don't know by who. What we do know is that this added to the case that there was now no way of lowering the water level in the lake in case there was an emergency. Ruff, excited about his new purchase, had big hopes and dreams for the deteriorated dam. He wanted to create a resort for the rich and successful, making grand use of the lake and the surrounding area, offering fishing and hunting and whatnot. Because of this, Ruff, along with co-founder Henry Clay Frick, founded the South Fork Fishing and Hunting Club. A little thing we mentioned in last week's episode was that Mr. Daniel J. Morrell joined in with hopes of saving the South Fork Dam. In order for Ruff's plans to be a success, he had to first rebuild the old and partially failed South Fork Dam. The reconstruction happened, but some changes to the original design were to first be made. However, these design changes would later prove to be fatal. Already the dam was missing the 5 discharge pipes, which made the only method of reservoir level control being the spillway, which again was too small for the size of this dam and lake. As well as this, the height or crest of the dam was lowered by about 2 feet, or 0.6 meters. This was to widen the road that was on top of the dam, and recall the part of the dam that failed in 1862. It was replaced improperly with fill containing clay, brush, mining wastes, and hay. Not something
doesn't
particularly
seem like,
solid.
No, it doesn't seem like a really good structure you want to hold water in with.
I just can't get over the fact that someone was pinching pennies enough, or I mean scrap prices today are quite low in 2025 as we're recording this. I don't know what they were back then, probably a little bit higher, but literally just deciding like what was the payoff amount for excavating and removing these pipes and refilling wherever they were and hauling them off. So, like, it's just, if it was in today's standards and market, that just blows my mind.
I'm
that
only
someone
finding,
would dig these
finding
up.
It for pig iron, which is not the same thing, but that's $21.13 per ton, which would not have been.
I mean, back then that would be a lot of money, and it'd be very material. Heavy as well. Yeah. Who knows? I don't know, but that's just kind of wild.
I don't think it's
like,
worth
just
it. And
jeopardize my let's jeopardize this dam and sell off some crucial parts of it for scrap metal. I don't know. That just blows
which is
my
like
mind.
if you have enough money to throw around that you can buy a whole lake and dam and land around it, like you're not going to be pinching pennies enough that you're trying to scrap a couple of pipes. But I can see where like the first story, the really guy who sold it. And he was like, hey, like, I think I'm not getting a good deal out of this, so I'm going to take what I'm essentially selling to you and then scrap it and get that money. But because it's, like, alleged, not that he's around to still do anything, but, you know, it's not for sure if that happened, but...
It's just wild.
It makes more sense for him to do it than the person who just bought it and is like, yeah, let me just ruin this investment straight off the bat.
Pretty
in so many ways.
Insane, yeah. And if one thing is going wrong, why not have everything else do so? To add further structural issues into this mess, the dressed stone or natural stone that has been shaped, smoothed, and cut to specific dimensions for use in construction, which was placed on the upstream face of the dam, was not replaced. This allowed the water to come into direct contact with the main structural material. Direct contact is bad because it heightens the risk of erosion and eventual seepage, destroying the integrity of the dam. Womp womp.
Just bad decisions, front, right, and center.
Yeah. Aside from poorly rebuilding the dam, the steel and coal magnates who owned the dam and lake decided to build a 47-room clubhouse along with 16 elegant cabins on the shores of the lake. Club members and guests who stayed at the resort could go out in rowboats and sailing canoes, as well as two steam yachts that were kept specifically in the lake. Where would they otherwise be?
Well, it wasn't like they were going like up the river or anywhere. They're just kind of
I understand
kept
now.
In the reservoir.
Yeah, take this out to town, go get some groceries, you know? I was confused. Anyway, bass and trout were kept stocked, which... Many loved to partake in the fishing aspect. I've never seen a sailing canoe. That looks unsteady.
It doesn't look like a good idea.
Looks like you put a windsurfing sail on top of a kayak.
The one on the right has two. And then you're just like sitting on a couple elevated boards and looks like he's got a hard hat on.
Kind of does. Gotta watch out for the boom.
Watch out for that around you, because you just don't warn.
That's okay. You don't remember it. The South Fork Fishing and Hunting Club was rather keen on protecting their fishing profits, so they decided to use netting to cover the entrance to the spillway in hopes of preventing any of their precious fish from being lost to the flow of water downstream. As you can probably guess, the netting didn't just stop the fish, it also allowed for a buildup of debris such as sticks, leaves, and such, which reduced the flow going through the spillway in general. Sounds like they were just collecting materials to keep patching the dam.
No, that's what the hay is for.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
It would make too much sense to use this stuff.
Yes. During good weather, this isn't the worst thing imaginable, but everything was slowly adding up to make the dam not very resistant to storms or flooding. A bridge was added over the spillway as well, putting some weight on top of it.
Yeah, and some were saying that it kind of also blocked. So I don't know if it because of the poles going down was blocking some water. I don't know. I couldn't find a reason for why the bridge would be blocking some of the water in a spillway more than a net would be doing, but maybe.
Mayhaps. The materials used to repair the dam's rebuild up settled, which created a low spot on the dam's crest. This low point increased the potential for a concept called overtopping, which is where water flows over the top of a dam due to the reservoir level rising above the crest, more than likely due to heavy rainfall or snowmelt. This is dangerous for the dam, especially if it's made out of earthen materials, like the South Fork Dam was, as it causes rapid erosion that often leads to catastrophic failure. The overtopping in this case would have started off concentrated over the low spot, leading to an even faster erosion. When the dam was rebuilt in the early 1880s, the lake it now held back, Lake Conemaugh, was about 2 miles long, or 3.2 kilometers, 1 mile wide, 1.6 kilometers, and roughly 60 feet deep, or 18.3 meters. At the time, it was one of the largest man-made lakes. The lack of proper drainage ended up raising the lake up to around 70 feet in some areas, which is 21.3 meters, and it's not like the reconstructed section of the dam was helpful. It was constantly springing leaks, which required spot repairs of, you guessed it, hay and mud. But despite the headaches it caused, on August 10, 1885, Johnstown Daily Tribune said of the lake, quote, "The fine body of water and the romantic surroundings of the place, it is thought, would make the resort the most popular on the mountain," end quote.
I like the old-timey voice.
Thank you.
It is pretty from paintings. It looks peaceful.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
The differences?
I'm just looking at the picture.
It's really cool on this actual website, which I'll include a link in our socials, but it's got a little like slide thing so you can like see the first iteration of the dam and then the second one, and you can like slide it halfway, and then it has an explanation of what each point is, and it's really cool.
Yeah,
I liked it. Plus it's interactive. I always like something that's interactive.
Keeps you entertained.
I'm a child.
Now on to Johnstown itself. Johnstown was originally a settlement established in 1800 by Swiss immigrant Joseph Johns. The town saw growth with the turn of the 19th century, mainly due to the use of the Pennsylvania Mainline Canal. Johnstown became a port and a key transfer point along the route. When the canals were demolished due to the rise of railways, the town was actually just starting to pick up. Completely opposite to the life of the South Fork Dam so far.
Also, I find it so cool that they were trying to do a whole like canal system prior to railroads.
Yeah.
I mean, it included like some roads and some railroads too, but like also a canal system. Like that's just so like, I don't know, European aqueduct kind of thing.
It is really cool. And it's, I mean, it's shipping stuff via water. It's still the cheapest way and most efficient way to get it done. So
interesting.
As far as I know, I mean, it just...
Until you ran out of water.
Yeah, that would be a bit of a snafu in that mode of transport, I do believe. But I'm no expert. Also mentioned in our previous episode, Johnstown soon became home to the Cambria Iron Company, who at the time was the leading steel producer in the United States, even outproducing and outpacing the steel factories in Pittsburgh and Cleveland. By the 1880s, Cambria Works had grown into an impressive enterprise, taking over 60 acres in small Johnstown. This company also employed around 7,000 people and fueled the economy in order to support a population of around 30,000 individuals. Another fun little fact, the Cambria Works also was the country's main supplier of barbed wire.
Who knew?
Not all was sunshine and rainbows, as Johnstown and the South Fork Dam were slowly becoming known as an area prone to flooding by the time the 19th century was coming to an end. This increased rainfall led to the rising water levels in the valley. The rain once again was causing some damage in May of 1889, with the streets of Johnstown collecting pools of water due to the overabundance of precipitation. The high steep hills in the Kanawha Valley and the The high steep hills in the Kanawha Valley and the Allegheny Mountains to the east largely restricted.
Hang on, it's Allegheny. I'm sorry.
Allegheny.
I wasn't looking at it.
Yeah, took sure. Out a... Sure. Go for it. The high steep hills in the Kanawha Valley and the Allegheny? How do you say it?
Allegheny. Also, you got caught in my dad. I don't think I have to like copy Allegheny. And paste anymore.
Allegheny, yeah. The high steep hills in the Kanawha Valley and the Allegheny Mountains to the east, The high steep hills in the Kanawha Valley and the Allegheny Mountains to the east, largely restricted.
Just start
the high
to the steep... east, because I think you said east.
I know this. The high steep hills in the Kanawha Valley and the Allegheny Mountains to the east largely restricted the development of the town, keeping most of it close to the riverfront areas. On May 28, 1889, a low pressure area formed over Nebraska and Kansas, slowly making its way east over the next several days.
It's been a minute since I've been flipped off.
It was earned. 2 days. 2 days into its journey, the weather over east, that's literally the wrong direction. 2 days into its journey, the weather over western Pennsylvania was already starting to cause issues, with record-breaking rainfall being seen. Anywhere from 6 to 10 inches of rain fell in a 24-hour period. That would equate to about 150 to 250 millimeters of water. This type of rainfall caused small streams to swell into large torrents, with some even flooding their banks. The puddles accumulating on the streets of Johnstown were starting to form into regular flooding, leading many residents to become stranded inside their homes. On the morning of May 31st, 1889, Lake Conemaugh above the South Fork Dam had drastically expanded after the night of heavy rainfall. The lake level was now dangerously close to cresting the dam wall. Colonel Elias Unger, then president and manager of the South Fork Fishing and Hunting Club, at the time assembled a group of 15 men to try and save the dam. That's a never a sentence you want to like hear or say, like, help me, we're going to save the dam. Terrifying.
Yeah, yeah, especially like, it's not like, oh, we're going to prepare for future things. It's like, here, right
we're
now.
We're trying to save this.
Currently.
It's going down, yeah. Mm. Unger had built his house with a view of the club's lake and dam from where he could oversee everything. The group of laborers he gathered made their way to the spillway, whose netting was currently clogged with debris, and they attempted to clear the blockage. They were not successful. Unger also tried digging an auxiliary spillway on the far end of the dam, as well as plowing the crest to make it higher, but nothing worked. Seeing this, Unger sent one of his men to the nearest telegraph station in order to inform the residents of Johnstown below. Unfortunately, this message would never reach its final destination. By this point, it was already too late. The writing was on the wall, and Unger urged his men to retreat to high ground at 1:30 p.m. In a later interview with the Pittsburgh Post, Unger said, quote, Thursday night, when I went to bed, the water was no higher than usual, but it rained that night, and when I rose in the morning, the water was high. I went down to the dam and soon found the water in the big body rising an inch every 10 minutes, end quote.
Also, here is your trigger warning. It is not a happy story from here on out. In case you want to hear the end of the story, but just a heads up.
As they fled, the men could see the inevitable beginning to unfold. The South Fork Dam officially breached sometime between 2:50 and 3:15 p.m. This sent a tidal wave down the valley and headed straight towards the unsuspecting town of Johnstown. In total, it would take just over an hour to empty Lake Conemaugh's 20 million gallons of water. One witness said that the dam just seemed to, quote, melt away, end quote, while another observed that, quote, the entire lake began to move, end quote. Reverend G.W. Brown, who was also an eyewitness to the horrific events, remembered saying, quote, God have mercy on the people below, end quote.
What a helpless thing to feel. Like, yeah. There's nothing you can do anymore. Mm-mm. That is so heartbreaking.
The wall of water traveled the 14 miles, or 22.5 kilometers, towards Johnstown, picking up debris along the way. The flood was momentarily slowed by the Conemaugh Viaduct, which was a railway bridge that was part of the Allegheny Portage Railroad. But this slowing only lasted around 7 minutes before the waters destroyed this bridge. This caused the wall of water to increase its height and intensity before it reached Johnstown. On the way to Johnstown, a small town called Mineral Point was completely washed away in the flood. Other sources say that the flood also passed another small town called South Fork, but since it was on higher ground, minimal deaths and destruction occurred. The flood had a volumetric flow rate that temporarily equaled that of the Mississippi River, and the wall of water was estimated to be about 35 to 40 feet high. The Cambria Ironworks was the next thing to be demolished. The floodwaters picked up railway carriages, scrap metal, and barbed wire, to add to the other deadly debris in the churning torrent. In just under an hour, the waters hit Johnstown proper, traveling at a speed of around 40 miles an hour or 64.4 kilometers per hour. The flood hit buildings, people, animals, trees, vehicles, anything and everything within its path. The debris, which again consisted of barbed wire, rubble, and other dangerous things, crushed anyone and anything who was unfortunate enough to be out in the streets at this time, as well as bombarding any standing structures in its path. The water quickly reached Stonebridge just after rushing through the town. This 7-arch stone railway bridge spanned the Connemara River and was built around a year prior to the flood. This bridge became a pinch point where the debris was pushed up against it, in essence creating a small dam. This diverted the floodwaters out in other directions, causing more parts of the town to flood. But the worst wasn't over. The build of debris stuck by the bridge caused a fire that would burn for the next 3 days, killing many who had initially survived the flood, but became trapped by the debris and the stone bridge. This debris field and ensuing fire covered around 30 acres.
This shocked me. Not only is like a crazy flood that is just tearing everything down its path, you have freaking barbed wire in this. Like, it's one thing to have like, I mean, I'm sure if anything's coming at you 40 miles an hour in water, it's going to suck, like a tree or a person or a piece of a building or something. But barbed wire is insane. And then you have the debris getting stuck by a bridge. Props to whoever built that bridge. This is not moving. But and then it catches fire for 3 days over 30 acres. Like, that's a nightmare.
Nightmare fuel for sure.
It's just like compounding and getting worse and worse. And it's just your reaction is not matching what I assumed. It's just. I don't know. I was going over this and I'm like, this is just getting insane.
Yeah. No, it's.
You can't not really, blaming you, can, you no, for your you, reaction. I was just. Yeah.
Yeah. You can't really, like, you can't make it up. Like, this
it's
is
unfathomable.
Just, yeah. Hundreds of people died in the flood and the fire, and hundreds more were also swept away, some reaching as far as Cincinnati, 357 miles away. 777 bodies were never officially identified and are buried in the plot of the unknown in Grandview Cemetery. Overall, the total loss of life was 2,209 souls linked to the dam breach, 396 of them being children, 124 women, and 198 men were left widowed. To add to this, around 1,600 homes were destroyed and 99 families were completely wiped out. The cost of damages was approximately $17 million, which is almost $600 million U.S. in 2025. In property damage alone, which included 4 square miles of downtown Johnstown being completely destroyed. The cleanup would take years to sort through and take care of, but essential services such as the railroad and parts of the steelworks were quickly put back to work within a few days. As we mentioned in the Daniel J. Morrell episode, the Cambria Steelworks never fully resumed her number one spot in the country after this flooding, and while operations started up again a few days after the disaster, full operation didn't occur until nearly 18 months later. Rescue and cleanup efforts, especially during the early hours and days, were severely hindered by the vast amounts of barbed wire that was literally woven throughout the debris. The barbed wire was also partially embedded in the mud and ground and would hold down larger pieces of rubble while also posing as walking hazards, causing injuries to emergency workers just trying to work quickly and save whoever they could.
And there's some gnarly pics we'll include in our socials, but I think in this one right here, I think that's barbed wire you can see in the bottom left, it kind of looks like. I don't think it's just like scratches on the photo. But yeah, like that tree in that house.
Yeah.
It's insane.
Just
and this
insane.
Next one
ridiculous.
Is like, the quote was like, house was almost completely destroyed. I'm like, it looks pretty destroyed.
They're not coming back to that.
I don't even think there's a full room
yeah.
left. It's wild.
Yeah, it's horrifying. On June 5, a few days after the flooding, founder of the American Red Cross, Clara Barton, made it into Johnstown. This made the disaster the new organization's first major mission. The rescue and relief efforts took so long that Barton ended up staying in Johnstown for 5 months. Also, due to the time, the flood aftermath was able to be captured by a rather large number of photographs, which ultimately helped to raise funds for the town and its victims. But things weren't over just yet. With such a vast amount of carnage and death left in the wake of the flood, people wanted answers as to what caused such devastation and even as to who was responsible. It became rather obvious that the cause for the flooding was the failure of the South Fork Dam and its severely weakened reconstruction. However, investigations at the time also hinted that the original design also had its flaws and would have ultimately failed in the same situation. To add to the secrecy, the report from the American Society of Civil Engineers, or ASCE, would go unpublished for a bit even after their initial findings were reported. This was mainly due to the ASCE not wanting to be dragged into any potential litigation or legal action.
Cowards.
That is crazy.
Just like the cross section.
Yeah. What ended up happening was that the silence from the reports and then later the reports themselves let the highly wealthy owners of the South Fork Fishing and Hunting Club off the hook entirely for responsibility. On January 15, 1980, the ASCE released some info saying, quote, "The dam itself, or the parts of it which are left standing, showed undoubtedly that it was well and thoroughly built," end quote. However, the public knew differently and they were outraged. Imagine everything you know and love just comes to an abrupt end. It is clearly someone's fault, and they are getting off without any blame. In the long run, the club never had to face any legal ramifications, and even ended up writing the entire catastrophe off as an act of God. It wasn't until...
That just makes me so mad.
Yeah.
Like, you made decisions. You actively made decisions. Not realizing... Not assuming the consequences were going to affect you, and they didn't. But then when time came for, like, you know, someone to take ownership, they're like, oh, no, I think it was fine. Like, it's just because of the flooding. It wasn't because of me. We couldn't have helped it.
Yeah.
Oh, so mad.
It's very frustrating. It wasn't until 2016 that a reevaluation of the disaster proved that the extensive and improper modifications done to the dam were the main reason as to why it failed in the first place. Too bad this came out after those who were directly responsible were already long gone. To help a little bit with the whole justice angle, while the club members responsible for the dam legally dodged liability, many of them had to pay significant amounts to Johnstown. This included club co-founder Henry Clay Frick and millionaires such as Andrew Carnegie. As you can guess, despite all of this, the victims of the flooding didn't feel like they had received any kind of justice. The event itself became etched into the country's culture that would leave a legacy for more than 100 years. Wow, that's crazy. It's still there.
Yeah, you can't see my mouse. You can see where it dips down. Like, that's where it broke.
That checks out.
That's crazy. The big dip in the middle is what failed.
Is where it's gone.
Oh, gosh.
Glad to have you here to lead me through. I'd get lost in a lit room with one door.
Okay. Just let it go. It's fine. It's not that big a deal. It's not that serious.
Surprisingly, not much changed after the flood as far as regulations or legislation went. There was more outrage regarding how easily the rich dam owners got off with. In the 1890s, there was a shift in tort law, which is where a standard of liability is held for dangerous activities, and a defendant could be held liable for damage even without a finding of negligence. Another change was later laws regarding dam safety. Pennsylvania's first dam safety law wasn't enacted until 1913, but overall significant flood control wasn't enacted until another major flood in 1936 in the northeastern U.S. This Flood Control Act led to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers implementing extensive channel improvements in Johnstown and other flood-prone areas. You can still visit Johnstown and all of the bridges and prior dams that used to be. Some things have been rebuilt, others not so much. and it's a rather sombering event that in hindsight didn't have to happen. And that is the story of the Johnstown South Fork Dam catastrophe.
Good telling. There was a video of the guy who was visiting, and apparently his, I don't know if it was his great-grandparents or his grandparents, like his grandpa and his brother or something, lived in that area in like Johnstown, and they were out of town when this whole thing went down. And when they came back, everything of theirs and their family was gone. It was just like, that's it. No more. So they moved away and moved away to the south. And then this guy ended up growing up, I think in New Orleans or something, because like they moved away because of this. Like, it's just, It's crazy how much like was like set in place and changed after that. But yeah, they had nothing to come home to. No one to come home to. They're like, well, let's just start just over somewhere else because it's such a horrible memory. It's wild.
It really is. Very sad. Yes.
Very sad indeed. To switch it up, last week's trivia was true or false. Lake Superior has a natural phenomenon known as ice volcanoes. The answer is, drum roll. I can't do that. I disputed, but he did a drum roll. That was the world's quietest drum roll.
Thank you.
The answer is true. Did you know that Lake Superior has volcanoes? Well, at least ice ones. Apparently, they're not only on Lake Superior. Lake Erie has been known to have some as well. And we're sure we'd be remiss if we assumed the other three lakes didn't have any. Point taken. This is Lake Superior's photo of an ice volcano. No, Lake Ontario's photo of an ice volcano. So maybe all of them have some. Ice volcanoes are usually along the northern and southern shores in areas of high surf and strong onshore winds. Cones begin to form around the edge of an ice shelf as it starts to build out onto the lake. Waves driven by the strong winds hit the shelf. They break onto the ice shelf, building up over time. And after the ice has built itself out, waves continue to travel underneath the ice, being forced up through cracks in the previously formed cones in what looks like a mini volcanic eruption. Typically, for this phenomenon to happen, temperatures must be kept below freezing for long periods of time. And other ingredients used to make ice volcanoes are waves at least 3 feet in height, strong winds that blow the waves toward the shores, and pre-existing lake ice to provide the surface for the cones to form. Ice volcanoes don't always need to have just an ice shelf to form. Sometimes the ice shelves reach sandbars, which slows their growth process. However, the deeper water surrounding the sandbar can lead to larger waves and larger cones being built over the existing ice. Rocky reefs can provide similar effects as well. And if you want to deep dive more into the earth science-iness of it all, check out our sources page on our website to find the links used. And now before you just go frolicking up to these ice volcanoes, please know that the shelf ice can be rather weak and extremely unstable. It is unsafe to go out, and we, as well as actual experts, strongly advise not venturing out to pet the little volcanoes. I know it's fun. Don't do it. Some places do offer guided tours where you can go and see these natural marvels themselves, so perhaps check one of those out. Other than that, happy ice volcano hunting. And I love this photo of a guy next to an ice volcano, which, again, don't do. He's either dramatically flailing because it erupted, or he's dabbing. I'm not sure.
It looks a lot more like the former.
He's just like, it's a wave.
Yeah, it's like a.
It's very funny.
Stock photo of a guy freaking out, like, But there's more to the photo.
It's hilarious. This week's trivia, come on, it hasn't been that long. You should remember the drill. No trivia this week. Stop by here next week for more Great Lakes and Shipwreck Adventures and stories. Send us your Christmas shipwreck wish list that we can cover. Not the ones you'd like us to sink. We're not that kind of podcast. We'll just make sure to pass those along to Santa Claus. Instead of sending it to the North Pole, Santa likes to direct his Great Lakes division to underthewavespodcast@gmail.com. The elves have been working hard at keeping the photos for each episode showing up in all the socials. Just search for Under the Waves Podcast, and then give Comet a little love by visiting our website, www.underthewavespodcast.com. He's been working hard on that, and hey, Rudolph was already booked and a little out of budget, so Comet it is. Comet's our guy. Go, Comet.
Share this with someone who refuses to drink hot beverages in the winter. I happen to know at least one person. Some people clutch their steaming mugs all winter long like they're auditioning for the next Hallmark movie. And then there's this person. You are the one person marching through a blizzard with an iced drink like it's the middle of July. You are the person who orders a venti iced latte while snow is actively collecting on your windshield. Brace yourself because you're about to be asked, "Aren't you cold?" at least 7 times while holding your drink. But you'll just end up taking an even bigger sip out of sheer spite. Do you know who you are? You never once have been tempted by a hot chocolate, even if there's whipped cream and sprinkles on it. You don't care if your fingers go numb. The drink stays iced. Your entire personality is, "I'll have it cold," even when the weather is trying its hardest to freeze you out anyway. Whilst everyone else is wrapped up in blankets, cradling tea like it's a therapy session, you're out there crunching through the frost and crunching through your ice cubes. Bonus points if they're already pre-crushed. You don't flinch. You don't waver, even if it's seasonal. You are loyal. You're committed. You bite the ice. We like that about you, and this episode is for you. But don't you dare be the person who likes freezing cold beverages yet prefers melted ice cream. Whatever would we do with such a conundrum? And your dentist probably would not like you chewing on the ice, so make sure they're small little pieces and be mindful of how much you consume. We release new episodes every Friday. And until then, folks, fair winds and following seas.
We'll catch you next time under the waves. Bye.
Cheers.
Maybe you should charge Dad for that advertisement.
Put your ice drink in a tumbler, I would say. You're going to get a lot less questions. People aren't going to know, but they hear go clinky, clinky, clink.
That's where the questions start. I think it's louder.
Well, if you hold it still and gentle, they won't know.
No, I think it's still louder.
Hot drinks